week. We're going to talk about immune cells and organs.
Yeah, this mouse is
So the purpose of the immune system is to protect our body from infections and pathogens. And your first line of defense is your skin. So, of course, anything that comes in contact with you, your skin should protect you. But if you have a cut or a puncture or something, like you breathe something in, one of your epithelial surfaces is damaged, then that pathogen is going to have access to your internal systems and be able, perhaps, to cause an infection. So there's two sorts of things that can happen. You can be infected by a virus, and that will infect your cells, and so there'll be cells that are infected. But some organisms are much larger than that, like worms, parasites, bacteria, and they might cause a systemic infection. So we have systems in place to kill infected cells, and we have systems in place to clear pathogens out of the blood. There's also two phases of this immune response, because if you get a local cut or something, you know, where a pathogen can get in, we have an innate immune system which will function to go right to that spot and very quickly try to prevent further infection and get rid of it. But if it does become systemic, then we have an adaptive immune response that will take place over the whole body, which is very specific for that pathogen, and will try to rid your body of it. The immune system is slightly different than other systems in the body, like the digestive system or the respiratory system, in that the major cells, the immune cells, don't stay in one place in the body. They circulate around the body, and they continually looking for what are called antigens, which can be proteins or lipopolysaccharides or anything that elicits an immune response can be called an antigen. This drawing over here on the right-hand side shows you the different components of the immune system. There are cells, there are organs that are distributed around the body, and then there's a system of vessels called the lymphatic system, which carries lymph and immune cells in the body. And I like this slide because it reminds us of that point, that the cells of the immune system are constantly wandering. They're not wandering purposelessly, but they're looking for something. They're looking for something to protect you against. So the immune system comprises cells, specialized cells, of the innate response and the adaptive response. And I'm going to show you what those cells are, and we're going to talk a little bit about them and learn how to identify them. And then the organs where these cells do their job, which are the lymphatic organs, either primary, where the lymphocytes develop to begin with, or secondary, where mature lymphocytes and the antigens come into contact with each other. We can also include the circulatory system, because that's the route that these cells travel around the body, and as well as the lymphatic system, because that's how we collect them back. This cartoon just briefly introduces the idea of the differences in response time between the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. The thing about the innate immune system is that the cells that we're going to talk about have receptors for what are called pathogen-associated molecular patterns, or sometimes you'll see the phrase PAMPs. What that means is that on the surface of bacteria and other pathogens, there are specific patterns of molecules, and the cells of the innate immune system have specific receptors for those, but all the cells have the same one. So it doesn't matter if this neutrophil or that neutrophil comes into contact with that particular antigen, they will all act the same and they will all be able to attack that pathogen. And that's as opposed to the cells of the adaptive immune system, which are highly specific. And these are probably the cells that you think about most when you think about the immune system, because these are the ones, if you have a vaccination, these are the ones that form the memory cells so that next time you get exposed to that pathogen, you can have a quicker, faster, better response. We're not so aware of these cells that are in the innate immune system. This shows you, just to give you the overall idea, a microbe breaching the epithelial barriers, and the kinds of cells and other components of the innate immune response that might come into play, including phagocytes. That means they can phagocytose and display the antigen. Other kinds of cells, like NK cells, I'm going to talk about them a little bit more. And this occurs over just several hours, primarily right at the site of the infection, and you'll see a red spot and inflammation there. The cells of the adaptive immune response include lymphocytes, both the ones that make antibodies and the ones that are capable of actually killing infected cells. And this takes place over several days to a couple of weeks. If we take a sample of blood, and we can identify the cells of the immune system, and a lot of people do this if you're doing research on them and you want to collect blood from normal donors or whatever donors you have, or mice, this is one way that people collect those cells. So the cells of the immune system are called white blood cells, and that's what leukocyte means. Leuko means white, so leukocytes are the white blood cells. These are different types of cells, granulocytes, which include neutrophils, eosinophils, and basophils, and I'm going to show you what they look like, and non-granulocytes, monocytes, and then the lymphocytes. So on the left is a sample of blood. If you take that blood and you spin it down on a Fickle gradient, you can separate out those cells. The fluid that's left is plasma, and that will be at the top. The red blood cells will sediment to the bottom, and there'll be a very thin white line of cells that people call the buffy coat. And if you take those out, that's where all the white blood cells will end up. So that you can see, compared to the number of red blood cells, there are not very many white blood cells in the blood at any one given time. I wanted to make a distinction because a lot of times we talk about plasma and we talk about serum. Plasma is actually the liquid part of the blood. So if you want to collect, and serum is what's left after the blood coagulates, after the clotting factors clot and you spin it down. So if you want those clotting factors and you want other things in the blood, you want to collect plasma. So you put in an anticoagulant into your sample. We're going to talk about where all these cells come from, because there's all these different types of immune cells. Where do they arise? They arise through, and it's misspelled in your handout, so you can correct that if you want to. I apologize for that. But they arise through a process called hematopoiesis. And this process begins with stem cells. These particular stem cells are pluripotent hematopoietic stem cells. So they are capable, the pluripotent part means that they're capable of giving rise to a wide array of different cell types that become progressively more and more differentiated. There's two main lines of differentiation. The myeloid lineage produces cells of the innate system primarily. And that the secondary stem cell is called the common myeloid progenitor. Then the other kind of progenitor cell that can differentiate from the pluripotent hematopoietic stem cell is the lymphoid lineage, or the common lymphoid progenitor. So as I just said, if we start at the top of this hierarchy with a pluripotent hematopoietic stem cell, this cell, if we follow these cells, they have the characteristics of stem cells, which are, there's two characteristics that form a stem cell. One is that it will divide and it will be self-renewing. So when this cell divides, it makes one common myeloid progenitor cell, and it reforms itself. So there's so the two daughter cells don't have an equal fate. If we go down and we look at this common myeloid progenitor hierarchy, then it becomes progressively more differentiated. This will be a precursor to the granulocytes. Further down in the granulocyte lineage, we find another precursor cell. And finally, the three different types of granulocytes will be formed: eosinophils, neutrophils, and basophils. The granulocytes are our front line of attack. And they are characterized, we can differentiate those three different types by what kind of granules they have in their cytoplasm. These granules are released when they come into contact with the pathogens, and they have the ability to kill those cells, kill pathogens, and also release cytokines and other chemicals that are going to draw in more of an immune response. Characteristically, they all have a multilobe nucleus. We always think of a cell nucleus as being round, but these have several lobes, and people think maybe it's to help them go through narrower places. Neutrophils are the most numerous. The number of neutrophils increases when you have an infection, so that can be diagnostic. Leukocytosis can be diagnostic of an infection. They kill microorganisms by phagocytosis, and then when they die, they're the main component of pus that you find in an infected area. And this is what they look like. So you can see it's kind of a roundish pink cell. It has many lobes in the nucleus. It looks kind of like an ant or a wasp body. But if you saw this cell, it's very distinctive. Because the granules are neutral, they're not acidic or basic, they have a very neutral kind of pinkish look that makes them easy to identify. They last for about 7 or 8 hours. They come out of the bone marrow, go into the blood, go to the site of infection. And they have this is a cute little movie if you want to see it. It was made a long time ago, and it shows a neutrophil chasing a bacteria around in the blood. So you can see that on YouTube if you want to. But one thing that was discovered about neutrophils in the last maybe less than 10 years that seems very strange at the time, but apparently now people have seen it happening in vivo in the body, not just in test tubes. And that is that neutrophils, one way that they can kill is by extruding these what are called extracellular traps. This is a scanning electron micrograph. And what that is their nucleus. As they're dying, they fling out DNA like a big net and just kill and trap pathogens in it. And there are a variety of cytotoxic chemicals that are attached to it. So they can disarm and kill bacteria. So here you can see intact cells with granules, and here's the nucleus. Then as the cell begins to die, it flings out through the orange nucleus, is stained orange, and here you can see these orange nets coming out. In this micrograph, you can see bacteria that are entrapped in these nets. So, Dr. Siegel, Bram Siegel, his lab works on those nets, if anybody's interested in talking to those students. The second kind of granulocyte is an eosinophil, and the way we can tell those is because the granules are very bright red. If you look at them in a blood smear under a microscope, they just shine. They're very refractile and shiny. And the third kind, oh, this is a mast cell. These look like eosinophils, but we see them in tissue. So they leave the bone marrow before they're differentiated. They go to the tissues and become resident cells, and then you'll find them in the tissue. If you're working on breast cancer or mammary cancer, you see a lot of mast cells in the tissue. And the third kind of granulocyte is basophil. And these granules stain, they're very rare. It's hard to find one in a blood smear, but when you do find one, then mostly what you see is just these very large dark purple granules that obscure the nucleus. And all of these cells are larger than red blood cells, which are about 7 microns. So these are bigger. These are maybe like 10 or 11 microns. Another kind of cell that comes through the myeloid lineage are monocytes. And the monocytes can go on to form, differentiate mostly into macrophages, but they can differentiate into another kind of cell called the dendritic cell, too. These cells are phagocytic, so they take up antigen in the periphery, and then they display it to the cells of the adaptive immune system to stimulate them. So in that way, they are a bridge between the adaptive early immunity and the later, the innate immunity and the later adaptive immunity. So they are cells of the innate immune system. They have the pattern recognition receptors. But once they're stimulated, they phagocytose antigens, reprocess them and display them in a way that the cells of the adaptive immune system can see them and respond to them. They primarily interact with lymphocytes in the lymph node, which we're going to talk about later, so we'll come back to that. And they secrete proteins, cytokines, and chemokines that attract and stimulate other cells of the immune system. And this is represented here. Here's a monocyte. This is the form that you'll see the cell in the blood, in a blood smear. But it travels in the blood, it will arrive at a tissue, exit the blood, and differentiate into a macrophage or a dendritic cell. This is what the monocytes look like, and they're pretty distinctive also because the nucleus is large and it's shaped a little bit like a kidney bean. And then you can see what they look like in comparison to the red blood cells. There are also, in addition to the monocytes that travel around through the blood, before people realized that macrophages were all the same cells, they were discovered and identified in different tissues and given different names in different places. So there are macrophages that are resident in the liver, and they're called Kupffer cells. There are macrophages that are resident in the bone marrow, and they're called osteoclasts. And there's several other kinds. So there's the motile kind that travel around in the blood and also resident tissue macrophages. Here you can see how much bigger they are than the cells of the surrounding tissue. Dendritic cells are what we call professional antigen-presenting cells. These are the ones that can do it the most efficiently. They have an immature and a mature form. The immature form is deployed around the body. In your skin, there are dendritic cells. They are specialized in phagocytosis, so they take up the antigen. Once they take up the antigen, they mature into mature dendritic cells. They become mobile, and they go to the lymph nodes where they're going to interact with lymphocytes of the adaptive immune system. So these were discovered fairly recently in the 1970s, and the person, Ralph Steinman, that discovered them went on to win a Nobel Prize, because that bridge from the innate to adaptive immunity hadn't really been understood before. And this is what a dendritic cell looks like. They're called dendritic cells because they have these branches that reminded people of dendrites, nerve cells. So they have all these long dendrites, and this is what they look like in culture. This is what they look like in a in a slide of the skin when it's been stained for class 2 MHC. So they look like they have these long dendrites, but in fact, if you look at them with a scanning electron microscope, you can see that these aren't really processes as much as they are big waves of cell membrane so that they can engulf things. Another kind of cell that comes from this lineage are the megakaryocytes, and we're not going to talk about them too much. They give rise to platelets. So interestingly, they're really large cells. They pinch off little balls, little pockets of membranes, and those go into the blood as platelets and are involved in clotting. And lastly, from this myeloid lineage is derived the red blood cells. The red blood cells lose their nucleus during time that they're differentiating, so when they come into the blood, they're enucleated. There are some animals that retain their red blood cells, as do human embryos. So in a pregnant mother, you might find nucleated red blood cells that came from the fetus in the mother's blood system. And these are the red blood cells of a salamander. Now if we look at the other side of that process, if we look at the cells that come down through the lymphoid lineage, we have the common lymphoid progenitor cell, and that gives rise to lymphocytes. There's three different kinds of lymphocytes. The NK cells are part of the adaptive innate immune system, and then there are lymphocytes that are part of the adaptive immune system. You can't tell these apart. Unlike the granulocytes, you can't tell these apart just by looking at them. They have surface markers, and you can identify them by flow or immunohistochemistry. But just by looking at them, you really can't tell them apart. Some of them are T cells, and we'll learn what that means in a couple of minutes. It means that they mature in the thymus. That's what the T comes from. And there's many subdivisions of T cells. The two primary divisions are cells that express the cluster of differentiation 4 marker, CD4 positive. Those are the helper T cells. And there are cytotoxic T cells that express CD8. So that's the main way that you can tell them apart. The CD4s recognize antigen in the context of major histocompatibility 2 molecules, and the CD8s recognize antigens that are held in the MHC class 1. So that's not something that we're going to go into in this class, but it's that is a distinction between them. The second kind of lymphocyte are B cells. These mature in the bone marrow. These become eventually antibody-producing plasma cells. So the T cells are responsible for killing other cells and organisms. The B cells are responsible for making antibodies once they become plasma cells. And the third kind of lymphocyte are the NK cells. They're part of the innate immune response, and they kill cells that don't have any MHC at all. So it's a balance. Sometimes tumors, like all cells express class 1, but sometimes tumors stop expressing class 1, so then T cells can't recognize them and can't kill them. And in that case, maybe the NK cells can kill them because now they've lost that expression. And these are T and B lymphocytes. And you can see they're a little bit smaller. They're larger than red blood cells. But one characteristic is that they just don't have very much cytoplasm. So right now we're trying to do one of the graduate students in the lab is trying to do some experiments with the seahorse upstairs with lymphocytes. They just don't have very many mitochondria, so you need a lot of cells if you're going to study them because they're so skimpy on the cytoplasm. This makes them easy to identify if you're looking at slides because the nucleus stains dark purple, the cytoplasm stains a little lighter blue. So sometimes when you see them in slides, they just look like a cluster of purple marbles. Your eye is just drawn right to them, and you'll see that in a couple of the slides. These are the cells, as I said before, that are responsible for the specificity of the innate immune system, of the adaptive immune system, and also the memory. This slide, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going over. This just shows you a few of the different types. And what I really want to point out is just down here. It's the common lymphoid progenitor gives rise to NK cells, B cells, and T cells. And then if you look, you can see how many different divisions there are of the T cells, either helper T cells or cytotoxic T cells. And there are many different kinds of helper T cells. Those cells, depending on how they're stimulated, they secrete different cytokines and different chemokines. So they can tune up the immune system to either go towards making more antibodies or go towards more of a cytotoxic T cell response. So that's why they call them helper cells. So the question is, if you have a cytotoxic T cell, what is it going to do to really kill another cell? How is it going to kill a tumor cell? And there's two main ways. These lymphocytes can either have what are called death ligands on their surface, which interact with the death receptors on the surface of other cells, such as FAS ligand, TRAIL ligand. And when this interaction occurs, so this is a cytotoxic T cell. When it's activated, it starts to express these death ligands. And then if the target cell expresses the receptor, that interaction will initiate an apoptosis pathway. So the cell will kill itself. And alternatively, what's in the granules in T cells are perforin and granzyme. And the perforin forms pores that perforate the surface of the target cell. And then this enzyme granzyme can go through the pores, go into the cell, and again, initiate apoptosis. So the CTL killed by apoptosis, but it's initiated in two different ways. This list is not something I'm going to ask you about, but it helps you understand how we can differentiate the T cells. And there's more and more and more markers being discovered all the time, so that even any one of these cells can be in different states of activation and express different markers. So people who are doing flow for lymphocytes have, 10 different markers that they can use in a panel to really hone in on what the function of the cells are that they're looking at. But all T cells express CD3. So if the cell expresses CD3, it is a T cell. And then we have either CD4 or CD8 T cells. And let's see, where's a B cell? CD21 is a B cell marker. So anyway, that just gives you an idea of how we can differentiate between the different cells functionally or phenotypically, because you can't tell them apart visually. This is a small lymphocyte before it becomes activated. And again, you can see that the nucleus is condensed, so the cell is in a resting state, and there's not much going on in the cytoplasm. But once the specific receptors on the cell surface see their antigen, the cell becomes activated. And the chromatin becomes decondensed. You can see a lot of endoplasmic reticulum in the cytoplasm because it's starting to make proteins, and in this case, this is a B cell. And then as it differentiates into a plasma cell, you can see how much endoplasmic reticulum it has. This is the Golgi apparatus next to the nucleus. And these cells can make an amazing amount of antibody. They can make 100 to 1,000 antibody molecules per second. It's just very amazing. This is a multiple myeloma, And this is the only way that we, this is very abnormal to see this many plasma cells in the blood, but we can see what a plasma cell looks like. And here's the nucleus, here's that light area with the Golgi and the endoplasmic reticulum. So you'll find them like that in sections of slides sometimes. This this panel summarizes the different kinds of antigen-presenting cells. We talked about dendritic cells. This shows you what they look like in microscopy. This is transmission and scanning microscopy. We talked about dendritic cells. We talked about macrophages. The other kind of cell that can present antigen is one that we haven't talked about, but B cells also, under some circumstances, can present antigen. I wanted to show you just briefly where hematopoiesis occurs, because we know that in the adults it occurs in the bone marrow, but in the early in embryology, hematopoiesis is taking place in the yolk sac. So, you know, sometimes when you get an egg from the grocery store and you crack it, there's little blood spots on the yolk, and those are the small little hematopoietic islands that are starting. That egg's not fertilized, it just starts to make a few little islands. Sometimes you can see them. So early on, these blood islands are found in the yolk sac of the embryo. And these are of the myeloid lineage, so there aren't lymphocytes being formed in the small, in the young embryo. Then that process of hematopoiesis eventually moves over and starts taking place in the liver, and for a very short time in the spleen. So the fetal liver is actually a hematopoietic organ. And so is in a mouse, you can see it sometimes in the liver. And in the mouse, you can see some aspects of hematopoiesis in the spleen. But eventually, all of this moves into the bone marrow. This is an embryonic liver, and I'm sure it's hard for you to see, but I'm telling you, there are hepatocyte liver cells here. And in between, we can see clusters of hematopoietic cells in a fetal liver. And this is what bone marrow looks like. This is a bone spicule. So this takes place inside your hollow bones. These are adipose cells, and then still blood islands that we can see. So that gives you a brief overview of the cells of the immune system. So now we're going to go on and look at the organs of the immune system and try to understand where these cells are and how they move around, where they encounter their antigen. The biggest question to understand is, where do immune cells actually encounter antigen? And that's what we're going to talk about. So there are several different organs that we include as being organs of the immune system, and they're listed here: tonsils, lymph nodes, spleen, tires, patches, and the appendix, and the thymus and the bone marrow. So if we begin down at the bottom by looking at the hematopoietic stem cells, and we just talked about the lineages, and that all takes place in the bone marrow. These are called, so the organs in which the lymphocytes and other immune cells differentiate, are formed and begin to differentiate, are called primary lymphoid organs. And those include the bone marrow and the thymus. So the T lymphocytes are originally formed in the bone marrow, and they travel to the thymus. In the thymus, they become mature but naive. They haven't seen their antigen yet, but they can respond to antigen, but they're in the thymus. The B cells are formed in the bone marrow, but they continue to mature in the bone marrow. But when the lymphocytes are mature and naive, they leave the primary lymphoid organs and they move into secondary lymphoid organs. This is where they're going to do their job. And as I said before, this shows where the primary, where the secondary lymphoid organs are arranged in the body. Oh, I stuck this slide in because the reason the cells, the lymphocytes, are called B lymphocytes because they were originally discovered in what's called the bursa of a chicken. And this is what it looks like. And you can see lots of these little dark cells. Those are the lymphocytes. And this looks a lot like a human thymus. And you'll see that in a minute. But in us, it continues in the bone marrow. We don't have this organ. It's just in chicken. So these are the two organs of the two primary organs. The thymus is in front of the heart, and if you dissect a mouse, you'll see it's just very thin and stringy. It's hard to find. And the bone marrow and all of the hollow bones. So the thymus is the site of T cell maturation, and the thymus forms in the embryo from tissue in the pharyngeal pouch. And it has to be seeded by lymphocytes, T lymphocytes that are coming originally from the yolk sac in the liver during embryogenesis, right? If the epithelial cells remain connected to each other and the lymphocytes just come and insert themselves between the lymphocytes, and then they proliferate and mature, and then they leave the thymus. But if the thymus fails to form from an embryological deficit, then, if the epithelial cells fail to form a home for the lymphocytes that are going to feed it, then you won't have a thymus at all. These are the epithelial cells, and you can see how they get stretched out with those lymphocytes, and they're just touching each other through desmosomes. This is something that's very characteristic of the thymus. Back when we used to have slides and slide tests on all the organs, if you can see a Hassel's corpuscle, then it's just a big swirl of epithelial cells. Then you'd know that it was the thymus. But this represents, I think, what the thymus looks like. I always think it looks a little bit like a sponge, and the lymphocytes are in the holes. If we look at the thymus to see what's going on in the thymus, what's the functionality of what's going on there, this is the outside of the thymus. So this is the capsule, and there's the septa that come down and divide it into lobes. The outside of any organ is called the cortex, and then as you move down into the middle, you reach what an area called the medulla. And functionally, the lymphocytes are compartmentalized. So the least differentiated lymphocytes are in the cortex. And they don't have any of those markers that I was talking about. They don't have CD3, they don't have CD4, they don't have CD8. So they're double negative thymocytes. And as they begin to differentiate, they begin to move out of the cortex down into the medulla of the tissue, and they begin to express these markers. And we have double positive thymocytes because they express all of them. Then, with further differentiation, they become single positive. They become either CD4 or CD8. And at that point, they're mature and they're ready to leave the thymus. And they leave through these venules. One other thing that happens in the thymus that's really interesting and it's very important is where the self-reactive lymphocytes are deleted. So if you think about it, the way lymphocytes work is they, through rearrangement of their surface receptors, their specific surface receptors, the genes, it's just random. They make receptors for everything they possibly can, and it's just random. So some of those are probably going to be reactive with antigens in your own body, but you don't want your immune system to react to your own body. So in the thymus, there are cells that are expressing all these different antigens, and any T cell that reacts with them undergoes apoptosis and is deleted. So hopefully, all of the lymphocytes that come out of the thymus won't react with self, and you'll be tolerant to self. If you graft a tissue from a different individual or organism onto an embryo, and those antigens are present, then they become tolerant to those antigens too. So there's this process that happens in the thymus that's extremely important for the functionality of the immune system. This is what the thymus looks like. This is where the capsule is out here. This cortex area is darker, and then the medulla is lighter. This is one lobe, and there's another lobe over here, and you can see where the mature cells are in the cortex, and then here's another portion of the medulla here. And then this is where the mature lymphocytes leave. The thymus changes during life. The one I just showed you is a thymus from a young person. It's very active. It's making a lot of lymphocytes. But as you age, you can see the maximum is during puberty, so 10, 15, 20 years old. Everybody has a very active thymus, and you're making lots of T lymphocytes all the time. But then as you age, the thymus becomes less and less and less functional and undergoes a process of involution. So this is one from an older individual. Mostly there's just fat and stroma and connective tissue. There's a little bit of the cortex left and a little bit of the medulla left, a lot of adipose tissue. And that's one part of the reason that our immunity declines as we age. We continue to make new lymphocytes all the time, but as you get older, it's less and less robust. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Is this why leukemia is more common in young people?
What?
Is this why leukemia is more common in young people?
I really don't know the answer to that question. I think probably not, but I couldn't say for sure. I don't really know. It's an interesting question, though. Mice that do not have a thymus, well, where a lot of us are very familiar with them, they're called nude mice. And in nude mice, the thymus failed to form during embryology, so they don't have any T cells. They have B cells. Nude mice became very popular when people realized, now I can put human tumors in a mouse and I can study a human tumor, because you can put human tissue in the mouse, it doesn't have T cells to attack it, and it becomes very, very unable to reject the human tumors. So they've been very popular in research for many years. We call them immunodeficient mice. SCID mice are also immunodeficient, but they're immunodeficient for an entirely different reason. Humans can have the same condition where they lack a thymus, and that's called DeGeorge syndrome. And it has to, one, it basically is a defect of the neural crest cells. But one aspect of that is the loss of the thymus. What we call the embryological progenitor of the thymus, the word is onlaga, so they are lacking the onlaga of the thymus. There's no place for the T cells to go, so those individuals are immunodeficient. But because it's a defect of the neural crest cells, they also have a lot of other problems. There can be facial deformities and things like that. But this was an interesting little tidbit I came across a couple of years ago. So these individuals that don't have a thymus have a very compromised quality of life, because they're always on the verge of, you know, an infection. They have to be very careful. But in a beginning type of experiment, scientists have been able to grow a thymus taking embryonic mouse embryonic fibroblasts that they reprogrammed to be thymic epithelial cells. They implanted those thymic epithelial cells in the kidney of a mouse, and then the T cells had a home to go to, and the thymus grew in the kidney of the mouse. So I think that's a hopeful start for individuals that are lacking a thymus. So those are the two primary lymphoid organs, right? Those are where the lymphocytes develop and they mature. Then when they're ready, they come out into the rest of the body and they go to secondary lymphoid organs. Secondary lymphoid organs are specialized for trapping antigen and enabling lymphocytes that are traversing the body searching for antigens to find it, to come into contact with each other. So I always think about it as like this room could be a secondary lymphoid organ. I'm an antigen presenting cell. It's not going to do you guys any good if you're all out there wandering around looking for me. So you all come through here looking for me. And that's like a secondary lymphoid organ. We can have an exchange. These lymphoid organs are specialized. There are specific areas for T cells, specific areas for B cells, and what are called follicles is where the B cells mature. Not really mature, it's where they come into contact with their antigen and proliferate. This is what a follicle looks like. It has an outside dark rim called the marginal zone. It's dark because these cells are not proliferating, they're very quiescent, so their nuclei are condensed and they're very dark purple and they don't have very much cytoplasm. When the B cells begin to proliferate, they get their antigen, they proliferate to make lots of them, clonally to make a lot of the same specificity, and they start producing antibodies. Then, remember the cytoplasm became enlarged, and that's why it's lighter in the middle, because these cells have more lighter cytoplasm. So that's a very distinctive feature. Lymphoid follicles are formed when activated B cells enter the lymphoid follicles and proliferate. They undergo changes that we're not going to discuss, but they undergo changes including somatic hypermutation, that's of their genes, affinity maturation, so how well do their receptors fit the antigen that they're specific for, and then they switch the type of antibody that they're making too. But all this goes on in the germinal vesicle. And selected B cells will become plasma cells. And some become memory cells, so they're ready for the next time. Lymph nodes and the spleen have a separate capsule around them. So if you look in the body, you could pick up a spleen, you can pick up a lymph node, they're individual organs. Lymph nodes, there's very clear difference between the lymph nodes and the spleen about what they're doing and where they're seeing antigen. Lymph nodes take antigen out of the lymph. Okay? So they're interposed in the lymph vessels. So all of the lymph that's traveling through lymph vessels gets filtered and sifted through the lymph nodes. And that way antigens can be taken out. The spleen doesn't have any lymphatics at all. It filters antigens out of the blood. And then, as you can see, the lymph nodes are more apt to, if we go back to talking about the skin, if I have an injury to the skin and an infection, an area of my skin will drain lymph down to a specific draining lymph node. So that reaction is going to be started in a more localized area. The spleen has all the blood from the body passing through it. So it's going to be more reactive to antigens that have become systemic. There are certain lymph nodes that are always, groups of lymph nodes that are always in the same place. So if you get a throat infection, people will feel your neck to see if they can feel glands. There are specific lymph nodes there, but they also pop up. Any place that you're, not lymph nodes, but, I'm sorry. There are solitary lymph nodes also that just form in the lymph vessels, and they don't have names, they're just there. This diagram shows you how this filtering from the surface down through the lymph nodes work. So this is the periphery, and you can think about this as being the skin, and there's lymphatic capillaries. Unlike the blood, we're all familiar with the blood, and maybe you are with lymphatics too, but we're all familiar with the blood, the idea that you have arteries that go out, the blood goes through capillaries, and it comes back through the veins, and it circulates through the blood system. The lymphatic system is just a one-way system. It doesn't have any outgoing vessels. It only has incoming vessels. So they start blindly in the periphery. They take up the extracellular fluid that's leaked out of the capillaries. And in a way, it's kind of washing the periphery. So this fluid is coming out of the capillaries. It's in the extracellular spaces. It's picking up antigens and whatever. And then it's draining through the lymphatics, down through the lymph nodes. See how the lymph node is just interposed in the lymph vessels, and then it continues. Eventually, the lymph goes back through the thoracic duct and gets dumped back into your circulatory system again. So all the cells and the fluid go back into the circulatory system. This little close-up shows how things can actually get into these blind endings, because there's spaces between the endothelial cells, and this is where the extracellular fluid is, and cells and fluid can just get in, and then they flow down to the lymph node. When they get to the lymph node, as I said, there are very specific areas in the lymph node. These are the incoming afferent lymphatics. This is the capsule. So this is the subcapsular space. There's macrophages deployed in here to phagocytose antigens. The cortex has the follicles for the B cells. There's an area underneath that called the paracortex where the T cells are located primarily. And then an area in the middle called the medulla, where a lot of plasma cells just get into, come down, take up residence in the medulla, and just pump antibodies out into the lymph and into the circulatory system. And this is what one really looks like. So these are the follicles, and each one of them has a light space called the germinal center, where the B cells are proliferating. This area is the paracortex, and then the medulla is in the center. And there are T cells up here too, in between the follicles. On the right-hand side, So now we're going to say, we're in the lymph node. How are the antigen and the cells going to find each other? The antigens and the lymphocytes going to find each other? It's because they come in from different directions and they pass each other. Kind of like rows of hockey players shaking hands as they go by each other. It allows for the maximum amount of contact between the two cell types, the antigen-presenting cells and the lymphocytes. The antigen-presenting cells, like dendritic cells, are going to come in from the periphery, what I just showed you. They're going to flow down and get into these areas of cells. They're going to just sit in there and wait for lymphocytes to come along. The lymphocytes, for the most part, come in through the circulatory system. So there's an artery. Here's the capillary system and the veins. And in the lymph nodes, there's extremely specialized post-capillary venules, or what people really call them more is HEVs, high endothelial venules. So usually those venules have very flat endothelium. Here they're elevated and they're very distinctive looking. Even microscopically you can see them. And they have adhesion molecules and markers that tell the lymphocyte, here we are, we're in the lymph node, you can come out here. So the lymphocytes extravasate into the lymph node through these HEVs. Here's one. Here's one. So they come out, and the dendritic cells that have come in this way are just positioned right there. So the lymphocytes come out, the dendritic cells are there, the lymphocyte can say, is the antigen you're presenting, is that the antigen that I'm reactive with, yes or no? If it is, then they stay there and they start to proliferate. If it's not, it just the cell just goes by to the next one, and then if they don't find one, they come back out in the blood, or the lymph, they come back down to the lymph, and they just circulate again. They just recirculate through the body, always looking. But eventually, the right lymphocyte will come along and start to proliferate. This particular slide shows you how lymph nodes are used sometimes in surgery. You can understand that if this is a tumor now, this isn't normal skin, this could be a tumor. Cells from the tumor could get into the lymph, you know, if lymphocytes and dendritic cells can get into the lymphatics out here, so can tumor cells, and they do. And they can come down into what's called the sentinel lymph node, that's the first lymph node, and become metastatic in the lymph node. And eventually they could leave the lymph node and go out through the blood or something and become metastatic somewhere else in the body. But when surgeons are doing surgery, a lot of times, particularly breast surgery, they can inject a colored dye in the tumor, and then if they dissect the lymph nodes, they can look and see which one is blue or which one is purple. Then they know which is the draining lymph node. They usually take that lymph node out, and the pathologist will look at it and say, yes, there's tumor cells in here, or no, there's not tumor cells in here. Okay, so let's talk about the spleen. As I said, this filters blood. there are no lymphatics going in or out of the spleen. The spleen is a complicated organ to understand because it's like two organs mashed into one. It has one function in what's called the white pulp, and that's a lymphatic secondary lymphoid organ. And then it has red pulp, whose function is to remove dying red blood cells. So they're different. The white pulp is organized around small arterioles. So there's a sheath of lymphocytes that is arranged around the arterioles. And the red pulp has cords of cells and empty spaces that are sinusoids. And I'll show them to you. This is where the spleen is in a mouse. If you open up a mouse, you can see the liver. You can see part of the intestine. Pancreas is in here, and here's the spleen. It kind of wraps around under the side. But if you lift that up, it's very easy with a pair of scissors just to cut that out. If you cut a spleen in half, and here you're looking at the freshly cut surface of a fresh spleen, just looking at it, you can see it looks like there's two different parts of it. That there are white places, that's why it's called white pulp, and there are red places called the red pulp. And they're distributed all around. And if you look really closely, you can almost see the arteriole in the middle of that cluster of white pulp. So in the white pulp reside the T cells and the B cells. And once again, they're separated. The T cells form the sheath, like my sleeve on my arm. The B cells form follicles that are located in the periphery of the T cell areas, just big bulging follicles. And this is what it looks like if it's cut and stained in the slide. And it's easier here to see. Now this looks more familiar to us, right? Because we can see all the lymphocytes, the small little dark blue cells, and right in the middle we can see the artery. So you can see how it's arranged around the artery. And this is just another view of the same thing. Here you can see again the white pulp. Here's an artery. So this is the superior periarterial lymphoid sheath. Maybe that's a follicle there with B cells because it looks a little lighter. And then all around you can see a lighter area that's in between the red pulp and the white pulp called the marginal zone. That's actually part of the white pulp. But that's how the lymphocytes get into the white pulp. They come in the blood, they're in the red pulp, and they enter the white pulp through the marginal zone. and then find where they're supposed to be, either T or B cells. This diagram makes it a little clearer, like diagrams always do. Here's the artery, here's the arteriole, and all of this area is the white pulp. So you can see the arteriole goes right through the white pulp, comes out into the red pulp, and then just dumps the blood out into the white pulp. So that was, now people know it's what's called an open circulation because there aren't capillaries there. The blood's just dumped out into the sinusoids and, or into the red pulp, and then eventually it finds its way into the sinusoids and goes back into the vein. This is the T cell area, the periarterial lymphoid sheath, and here's a follicle. And the brown represents the marginal area. So other than knowing what the cell types are in the areas in the spleen, we're not going to talk too much more about the function, different functions of the spleen. But I did want to show you what the red pulp looks like. So this is the red pulp, and these are the sinusoids. The endothelial cells of the sinusoids have open spaces between them. And you can see this better in the scanning EM. So this is the red pulp, and now you can really see where the cords of cells are, the macrophages and other cells here. This is a sinusoid, this empty space. So now we're looking at the inside of the sinusoid. The red blood cells get dumped out into the red pulp. In order to get back into the sinusoid, they have to come through these little tiny holes. And there's macrophages all around. As red blood cells get older and older, they become less flexible. So as they get old, they can't come through these little holes anymore, and they get stuck in the little holes, and the macrophages engulf them. So we have a constant turnover of red blood cells. At the same time, these macrophages are also engulfing antigens that are in the blood. And then these macrophages can go into the white pulp and present antigens to the lymphocytes in the white pulp. Then the last topic that I wanted to tell you about is the mucosal immune system. Just like I showed you a minute ago, and we have dendritic cells under the skin to help protect us, the mucosa, which is any of the soft epithelial surface, soft, moist epithelial surfaces, so inside your mouth, the digestive tract, inside your airway, inside the reproductive tract, any places where pathogens could potentially break through, we have a MALT, mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. So right underneath, there are lymphoid lymphocytes there to protect the surface. They respond to ingested, you know, if we eat a pathogen, if we breathe a pathogen. So you'll also see terminology that's different depending where in the body it's found. So as a group, it's called MALT, mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. But you can break it down to be a little bit more associated with different areas. So in the respiratory tract, it's called BALT, bronchial-associated, or in the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. What I want to show you is the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, tonsils, pyres, patches, and the appendix. These are all secondary lymphoid organs where antigens and where lymphocytes and antigen-presenting cells will make contact. The tonsils surround the opening to the pharynx. There's lots of different tonsils. It used to be very common. Has anybody here had their tonsils taken out? They hardly ever do it anymore. When I was growing up, people had their tonsils out almost routinely by the time you got to be 4 or 5 years old. So I had my tonsils out a long time ago because people get tonsillitis and get infections in their tonsils. So people would either have their tonsils or their adenoids taken out. But if you look, here's the tongue, the opening to the pharynx, and the tonsils are just surrounding the opening. and here. And you can see that the tonsils all drain to draining lymph nodes. This is the surface of the tonsil. Okay. So this is the inside of the mouth, the pharynx and the throat, the inside of the throat. And this is the epithelium that forms the mucosa. And underlying that, directly underlying that, are all these follicles and lymphoid tissue. This, the tonsils don't have a capsule around them, so you can't just lift them up like that. You would have to cut them away from the underlying tissue. They're characterized by having these really deep, by having these deep cracks or fissures that are called crypts. That's why the tonsils get infected all the time, because anything that any pathogen can get stuck in there, cells from in here can get stuck there. It's all really warm saliva. It's like culture medium in there. So anything that can be cultured in there can cause an infection. Now, if we move down the gut and we get down into the intestine, we find another specialized area of immune tissue called the Peyer's patches. These are in the ileum. They're in the first part of the last part of the small intestine. But if you look from the outside, you can just see these bumps. I think this is a cow. You can see these bumps called Peyer's patches. If we just cut right through there, you'll see what the Peyer's patches look like. Okay? So here's a cross-section. These are the villi in the intestine. This is the submucosa. This is smooth muscle. So when you look at that picture now, you've seen enough pictures of lymphoid tissue. You must immediately know that this is lymphoid tissue, right? Those are follicles. Those are the Peyer's patches. If we look at it from the inside surface of the intestine, then we see the mucus, and this is where the villi would be. But every once in a while, there's a little open space like that with a specialized kind of cell called an M cell. That stands for microfold, because the surface of the cell has lots of little microfolds. And they're specialized to take up antigen from the gut. In a diagram, we can see the villi, then we can see where the M cells are here. Right underlying that is a follicle from the Peyer's patches, and there's two cells, too, here, also two cells. If we zero in on one of these microfold cells, here's a regular villi cell that has microvilli on the surface. This is an M cell. It takes up antigen by pinocytosis, and it has this big cavity where all of the immune cells are. There can be dendritic cells in there, too, and they can send processes right up into the gut and feel around and take antigen out of the gut. So these are going to be activated here. And then, for instance, the cells that become plasma cells can take up residence in the villi and just pump antibodies out into the gut that are going to bind to this pathogen and opsonize it. And the last organ to look at is the appendix. This is just a little projection on the cecum of the large intestine. And if we cut it in half, cut it cross-sectionally again, we can see all of the lymphoid follicles that are forming the appendix. People, of course, have their appendix taken out too. I don't have mine anymore either. So I guess we've come to the end. So in summary, what you want to think about when you're thinking about the cells and the organs of the immune system, first, the different kinds of cells. Cells of the innate immune system, cells of the adaptive immune system. The different kinds of organs in the immune system, either where they develop or where they carry out their job, and the secondary lymphoid organs. And then if you think about that, when you're thinking about an immune response or you're studying it, try to think, okay, I have a petri dish. I can make something happen here. I can make two cells interact. But that doesn't really necessarily mean that that's the way it works in the body. So you have to try to situate what you're thinking about in terms of the organs and how things really work in the body. So, okay, thank you for your attention. I'm done. And if anybody needs to get in touch with me, Anand knows how. So, okay, thanks.